From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the author Ann Patchett, with whom I spoke about her essay collection, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, published by Harper. Ann Patchett is the author of 7 novels and 3 books of nonfiction. Last year, she published her first children's book, Lambslide, illustrated by Robin Price Glasser. A graduate of Sarah Lawrence College and the Iowa Writers Workshop, Ann Patchett has been the recipient of numerous awards and fellowships, including the Penn Faulkner Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Women's National Book Association's Award, and England's Orange Prize. In 2011, she opened Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee, with her business partner, Karen Hayes. She has since become a spokesperson for independent booksellers. In 2012, she was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Ann Patchett lives in Nashville with her husband, Carl Vandevender, and their dog, Sparky. Blending literature and memoir, Ann Patchett examines her deepest commitments to writing, family, friends, dogs, books, and her husband, creating a resonant portrait of a life in This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. The book takes readers into the very real world of Ann Patchett's life, stretching from her childhood to the present day, from a disastrous early marriage to a later happy one. It covers a multitude of topics, including relationships with family and friends, and charts the hard work and joy of writing and the unexpected thrill of opening a bookstore. During the interview, you will hear one aside that I had actually expected to take out of the recording. I mentioned at one point that I had been surprised upon listening to her essay or to her nonfiction book, Truth and Beauty, to hear the dates of Lucy Grayley's birth and death, because she was born on the same day that I was in 1963. It's not a very big deal, and it's not something I would normally keep in an interview, but that small aside led to a conversation about age that Anne suggested we leave in after all. So that's why that odd little segue is still in the interview. That comes later in the hour, though. First, because her book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, is a collection of essays, I began by asking Ann Patchett if the habit of writing essays leads her to see material everywhere. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think that probably the habit of being a writer leads me to see material everywhere.
Okay.
But it is really true that if I'm doing something that seems very interesting to me, I will often think, I should sell this, or this would be a good way to make money, or, you know, but I really want to tell people about this. So it's exciting to be in a great museum, but even more exciting if it's a great museum that you're going to get to tell other people about.
Sure.
Or if you read a great book, or you have some experience that you think people should really know about this. And that's when it's the most fun.
Yeah, and that so comes true as a reader, too. You just can tell when the person really is sincere, you know, and it was truly an experience they wanted to write about.
Right.
Yeah.
I can remember once I was in Petoskey, Michigan, at my very favorite bookstore, McLean and Eakin, and I had just come home, and I must have been up there to give a reading. I mean, I don't actually remember why I was up there, but I imagine that's why I was up there. And I had been home a couple of days, and the New York Times, they have that T magazine, the sort of big magazine that comes in the New York Times maybe once
yes.
a month. And this was the T travel magazine, and they called me and they said, "We want you to write a piece on Traverse City, Michigan, and the film festival." Mm. And I said, "No way. I am not going to turn around and go back up there. I just got in the door. I just got my suitcase unpacked. But I would be very, very happy to write a piece about Petoskey, Michigan, which is 50 miles away or whatever, and my favorite bookstore." And they said, "Oh, yeah, sure, that'll do." That'll be every bit as good. Poor film festival. Didn't get a shout out that year.
That's amazing.
So a lot of times the answer is, you know, somewhere in between what you've done and what they need.
Yeah, yeah. I would think that's because of where you are in your career. I mean, you couldn't have done that at the beginning.
Probably not. No.
Probably not. Do you think that breaking into writing for magazines has gotten a lot harder? Do you?
I don't have any idea how someone could even do that now. Magazines kind of don't exist, you know, in the same way that they did when I was coming up. There are so many fewer magazines, and I think that magazines rely much less on freelance writers. With all the digital magazines, it seems more and more what people want is content without paying for it. Mm-hmm. Places like the Huffington Post, they don't pay their writers.
Right.
You know, they'll call all the time and say to me, oh, write about this or write about that. And I think, but you guys don't pay. I mean, you don't even pay $50.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're moving into a time in our collective American consciousness where we believe that content is free.
Mm-hmm.
We should be able to download our music and our books and our movies, and there should be online magazines that go on forever with free content. So the idea of actually making a living as a magazine writer in a time when there are not only fewer magazines, but there's so much free content, I think it would be incredibly hard.
Yeah.
One thing that I encounter a lot from magazines and newspapers that never used to happen is that the writer from the magazine will call and they'll do roundup pieces, which means they will be talking to three or four or five different people. What is your take on X subject?
Right.
And they'll interview you, or they'll interview you over email. So basically you really are writing it and sending it in, and then they assemble it into a piece. But again, it's that they're quote-unquote interviewing you and you're not writing the piece, even though you have, in fact, spent that much time sitting down and writing.
And doing it, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk, too, about some of the essays in this book, obviously. I really enjoyed reading some of your thoughts about writing fiction. You have an essay called The Getaway Car, which has a lot of information about writing fiction. I was interested to read that you map out your novels before you settle in to write them. And you don't just let the plot and characters lead you like a lot of writers say one has to do. And I was glad to read that you do that. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the nice thing about putting a novel together is there is no right way to do it. It's
mm-hmm.
just, you know, if it works in the end, then it works, and that's your way of doing it. To me, I have to know where I'm going. I always say it's like planning a trip. You can be surprised and change your mind and go different ways, but if you're going to drive across country, it helps to know where you're going. I don't like to just wander or meander. I don't want to write long scenes that are well written but don't advance the story. So to advance the story, I need to know personally where I'm going. I think that part of it comes out of the fact that I was working on my first novel when I was a waitress, and so I got in the habit of just putting things together in my head. I was giving a talk a couple of nights ago someplace in America where I was on book tour, who only knows, and somebody was asking me about this, and I said, you know, it is like the fact I never learned how to type, because when I was in high school in the 70s, I really believed that if I took typing, I would become a secretary and that I would never become a writer, and that I was protecting myself by not giving myself the option of doing that kind of work by not learning how to type. It, of course, was the stupidest decision I ever made, and I never learned how to type, and all I do all day long is type. Now, I type really fast, and I look at my hands. I cannot transcribe at all. I can't read a piece of paper and type. But I do fine. And, you know, again, I get the job done. It might not be the right way, but I can get it done. And I think that, again, putting a novel together is very much like that. I don't know how to type. I probably don't properly know how to write a novel, but...
Well, it seems to be working
But I manage it. I manage it just fine in my own weird cobbled-together way.
And I have the sense from reading your essay that you also then allow your map to change. You might know where you're going, but like you said, you can go various ways to get there, but you let the story tell you if your map is wrong, right?
Yeah, and I have a certain hesitation about saying you let the story tell you, because I think that so many people want to believe that the characters take over.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, that you are sort of channeling your book. And I'm a very strong proponent of the fact that I am writing a book. I do change my mind, but not for some sort of hocus-pocus reason. You know, it's not a Ouija board.
No. And it's funny.
It's not dictating to me.
I think I only said that because it's something that's said.
Yes, exactly. And it really is. People really want to believe that. And I think that there's a whole deeper underlying message in that, which is, because people so strongly want to believe that stories are channeled and that the characters do take over and that there is a muse and that there is inspiration, that they believe that this is a lightning strike situation and therefore it might happen to them. And I sort of feel like what I bring is both the good news and the bad news. And the bad news is it's not lightning strike and it's not going to just happen to you. But the good news is you can learn how to do this by developing skills and work and practice in the same way that you can learn how to dance or learn how to play the cello. You may never be great, you may never be Yo-Yo Ma, but you can learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be in a jolt of inspiration.
Right. One of the things you talked about was succeeding at an omniscient voice. You said that not until Bel Canto.
I say Bel Canto, but I live in Tennessee. It is actually Bel Canto.
Okay. Not until that book did you feel like you had succeeded at an omniscient voice. So what clicked for you, and what do you suppose hadn't been working up until that point?
Well, you know, I think it really took me the writing of four books to figure it out.
Oh, okay.
I think going back to what we were just talking about, it was a matter of working and trying and thinking very deeply and practicing over a period of time. My first book, Patron Saint of Liars, I tried to write in an omniscient third-person narrative voice, which, if somebody isn't familiar with what that means, it's that the point of view moves from character to character internally. And I couldn't do it. So I wrote that book with three first-person narrative sections, because it was the only way I could figure out, if the characters didn't communicate honestly with one another, how would you know what all the characters were thinking if you couldn't manage to do it in third person? So I had three first person sections. In my second book, I tried it again. I couldn't do it. So I had a first person narrator, but I had discrete third person sections of the book. So I was kind of just trying it.
Was that Taft or was that?
That was Taft.
That was Taft.
Then Magician's Assistant, I tried it again, couldn't do it. But in that book, I had a limited third-person narration. So the book was in third-person, but only in one character's point of view. So I feel like I can trace my progress through the years, that I'm very slowly moving towards this goal, which is omniscience. And in Bel Canto, I managed that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So you write in one of these essays, I think The Getaway Car, that you have a crisis of confidence with every new novel. This made me wonder, does success make that worse?
No.
No.
Success doesn't have anything to do with almost anything.
Okay.
Success has to do with my business life, my financial life, my travel life.
Right, okay.
But it doesn't have anything to do with my writing life. Writing is personal and private and me sitting alone in a room. And I write the book I want to read. I write the book that I feel is missing in my life. Mm-hmm. I write the book I long for, not the book I think my readers long for, not the book I think might sell, but something that's very, very much just my own. I don't have any career sense around sitting down to write, well, this is what I should really do now. I have a sense artistically of this is what I want to try, or this is what I haven't done in the past. I really want to do that now. I'm very interested in time. Bel Canto was a book about the suspension of time. Everybody gives away their clocks and their watches, mm-hmm. and the fog rolls in, and they don't know how much time has passed. So by the time I got through with that, I was exhausted by the suspension of time. I desperately missed time as a force that moves the narrative forward, because without time, it's really hard to move a narrative forward.
Yeah.
The Run is a book that takes place in 24 hours.
Right.
It is a real-time book. It is a book that the whole book is on the clock, and the character leaves the house at 2 o'clock in the morning and gets back at 3:30 in the morning and goes to sleep, and another character wakes up and then takes the story forward until 6 a.m., and then it's time to get ready for school, and that character picks it up. Because that was, as a writer, what I was craving, and I mean craving like food, that's what I had to do next. But I don't ever think, well, now my readers have gone through this experience of the suspension of time, so I wonder if my readers would now like a real-time novel. That just doesn't cross my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That very selfish.
Yeah, but you're your best reader, so you're sort of doing it for that reader.
You know, it's sort of like cooking. I'm not the best cook in the world, but I cook exactly what I want to eat.
Yeah.
And I say this as somebody who has been on the road for 6 weeks and sleeping in hotels and eating in restaurants. And I am craving my own food. I am dying to eat the food that I make, that I love.
Yeah. You talk about procrastination in the book. I loved this. You talked about the lists that you make, and then you'll go ahead and clean your oven and call Verizon and do all these other things before you'll sit down to
horrible
write.
Horrible things I don't want to do, but I do them.
So I wonder if we can just talk about procrastination a little bit, as you know, for a writer. How do you fight that when the time comes to write?
You know, it's interesting because I do talk about procrastination and think about it, but I also procrastinate a lot less than a lot of writers that I know. And when I was a kid in school, I would come home and do my homework. You know, I would walk in the door and have a snack and sit down and start my homework. And I would always finish my homework by, you know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. My sister was somebody who would start her homework at 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we worked the same amount of hours, but she did her homework from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., and I did my homework from 3 in the afternoon until 6 at night, you know, to the same effect. But I always felt like the procrastination wore her out. And I just think at this point in my life, I can say to myself, you know you're going to do it, so why not go ahead and just sit down and do it now? I will get those other things out of the way. I will say, all right, I'm going to go clean the refrigerator. I'm going to answer all of this email that I've been putting off. And that's a kind of procrastination. But my procrastination tends to be very productive. I don't think I don't want to write, and therefore I'm going to go have lunch with friends and go to the movies. I use procrastination as a kind of punishment. I'm not sure that I've ever realized this until I'm saying it just right now. But I fill my my docket with unpleasant tasks, and by getting those things done, by saying, well, you know, I'll do this unpleasant thing and then I'll get to the writing, which is really more unpleasant, but at least it's the thing I know that I really have to do.
Then in a way it feels like a reward because it's...
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
And right now I'm thinking, right now, today, in this conversation, in this moment, having just come off of book tour yesterday, and one of the funny things about book tour, which is so brutal and so hard, and you're doing all of these events, and that's not hard. The events are lovely, and meeting people is lovely, but you're on a plane every day, and mm-hmm. you're so behind and scrambling, and there's never any food, and you always have 4 hours of sleep, and that sort of thing. And then people come up to me in the signing line, and they say, so what are you writing now? And I think, I'm writing my name on your book right now. You know? That's what I'm writing. When do you perceive that I might be writing right now? While I'm giving the talk? I don't know. But here I am. I'm home. And it's over. And so there is that voice of like, okay, now, when do you go back to work? And I don't mean I may go back to work this afternoon or I may go back to work next week. But it is that thing of, well, I have a novel in my head. I've got a book I want to start. Do I want to say to myself January 1st? Do I want to say to myself February 1st? I mean, what's the day that I say, stop monkeying around, put the email down, put the books down, and sit at your desk and try.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got to figure out, what that day is going to be.
Plus, you have your museum piece for The Economist. So
that'll take me about 10 minutes, because I've done the notes, and it was so thrilling. I can barely sleep at night for thinking about the Harvard Museum of Natural History.
You have an essay in the collection. I should mention the name of the collection. It's This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and it's published by Harper. So in the essay called The Sacrament of Divorce, you give this real sense of your first marriage, which was an unhappy and a marriage that ultimately failed. You give a real sense of it without disclosing the details in that particular essay. You actually talk a little bit more about it later, but I was impressed by this combination of, you know, exposing your life and protecting your privacy. And I wondered if you could talk about how you approach this boundary between what to share in order to make your point and what to hold close.
Yeah. And of course, in every essay, it's different. You know, it's not like writing a novel where I sat down and thought, all right, these are my standards, and this is how I'm going to take on all of this. One of the things that I have really found to be true is if you are exposing things about other people, you have to expose things about yourself. You have to hold yourself to the same standard that you're holding other people to. And I think that you tell about 10%. And so that when I wrote This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, that title essay, which was a really, really hard piece for me to write, and the way I wrote it was to tell myself at every page, no one has to see this. Just write it down. Just write the truth. And then when I finished writing it and I read it and I thought, okay, this doesn't seem as bad as I was worried it was going to seem, I took it to my mother, my husband, my sister, my stepfather. And I said, okay, now you guys all read this, and you tell me if this is too much, if this is hurtful to you, if I've embarrassed you, because if I have, I won't publish it. Mm-hmm. But what I had done was, and what I did in all of these, is you tell about 10% of what happened, and you leave out a lot of the bad things that other people do and that you did. And so that when people who are close to you read the essay, what they come back and say to you is, thank you very much for not telling the other 90% of the bad things I did. I'm so relieved that you didn't tell all of these things. And then, of course, other people read it, people who don't know you, and they have a completely different experience with it. I know with the book Truth and Beauty, which was a memoir about my friend Lucy Greeley, and a lot of people who didn't know me and who didn't know Lucy thought that I had shared too much, or that I had been too hard on her or on us. But everybody who knew Lucy, everybody who was a friend of ours, called me up and said, oh my God, you were so nice to her. Because she was a lot more difficult than I portrayed her in the book. Yeah. And that's kind of the key. You know, pull back enough that you would never want to sell anything as being worse than it was. I remember when there was the whole James Fry Million Little Pieces blow up, and thinking, and maybe this is just my age, but just thinking, who says they're worse than they were? Right? I mean, the stories that I tell, I'm better than I was. Right. And the people around me behaved better than they did.
Yeah.
You don't get in trouble for selling people as being better than they were. But the notion that you would sell yourself as being worse than you were seems like such idiocy, because that's when you're going to get taken down.
Yeah, right. Now, what you just said about people reacting to that book, Truth and Beauty, actually, that just reminded me of something else that I remember when I read that book. You wrote about Lucy Greeley's reaction to having her life be more important to audience members at a reading than her writing and her process and her craft when she wrote Autobiography of a Face, and how painful it was for her that people didn't want to talk to her about her work. They wanted to talk to her about their own lives, mostly, it sounded like.
Right. And I would like to make one correction. It wasn't that it was painful for her. It was that it was supremely irritating to her. And that's, it's just a tweak, but it's a slight difference. She got mad about it, yeah. Not hurt about it.
Have you had moments like that in talking about either Truth and Beauty or these essays?
When people are more interested in the story than in the craft?
Yeah.
No, I'm at a different point in my life. For Lucy, mm-hmm. that was her first book, and she was trying to come into the world of literature and the literary scene as an important writer, and she was being interpreted as a cancer survivor and as a role model. So that was irritating to her.
Okay.
For me, you know, I'm down the pike, and so it doesn't really matter at this point how people interpret me. I actually feel like everybody should get to interpret me or my work or whatever they want to interpret, however they want to do
right.
it. Because interpretation is just a reflection of the person who is interpreting. It's
yeah.
not a reflection on you or on your work.
And you are putting it out there. So you're giving people permission to have a reaction.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. This is an aside, but I had the strangest moment when I actually listened to Truth and Beauty on, you know, an audible book, whatever. And toward the very beginning of that book, one of the very first things you say is June 3rd, 1963. That's the day I was born. And it was so weird. I have never heard anyone else say the day of my birth before, but I guess that Lucy was born that day too. And it was like,
yes.
Oh, that's so strange.
You have the same birthday.
Yeah, I guess so. So that
wonderful.
Was so funny. Sorry.
So you just had your big birthday, too. I turned 50 last week.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you, too. I was December 2nd, 1963.
Okay. I love being 50. It's really been good so far.
I feel great about it. And everywhere I go, I'm always saying, well, you know, I'm about to be 50 or now that I'm 50. Because I think it's so important to say to women, hey, look, you know, I'm having a great life, and I'm really happy, and I'm not worrying about how I look, and I'm not feeling like I'm out of the game, and I really want you to know I'm 50, and
yeah.
everything is great.
Yeah.
I want to be a good role model at every point in my life for my age, and a lot of that has to do with Lucy, and the fact that Lucy was more freaked out about getting older than anyone I have ever known. Every birthday was such a trauma. Mm. And of course, I'm sure it had to do with the lost childhood and all of the wasted time in surgery and the frustration that the clock kept ticking, time kept moving forward, and she still hadn't solved the problems of her childhood yet. But she would always say, you know, God, I don't want to be 40. I don't want to be 40. That'll be the worst thing in the world. And she died when she was 39, feeling like the oldest person in the world at 39. And once you hit 50, you look back and you think, 39? Are you kidding me? You were practically in grade school, you know?
Yeah.
You were so young. But because of that, I'll never feel bad about getting older.
Right.
I'll always feel lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
So.
You write in the book that you have inadvertently become the spokesperson for independent bookstores. I love reading about your opening Parnassus Books with your friend Karen. Is it Karen?
Karen Hayes, yeah.
Karen Hayes. So I wonder, how involved are you on a daily basis now with the bookstore? And if you just want to talk for a second about that.
Sure. I'm going in this afternoon because I've been gone for such a long time. I don't work at the bookstore. I'm the only person who's involved in this whole project that doesn't get a paycheck. And because that's not my job, I am in the bookstore a lot. I probably go in 3 or 4 times a week. And I'm just in and out. If it's that I'm picking up the mail or signing books, which is the main reason that I go into the bookstore, because people buy my books and they want me to sign them, and so they leave them in a stack in the back, so I'll run in and sign them, and I'll talk to the people who are shopping there, I'll talk to the people who are working there, who are all my friends. I recommend books. write a blog every month about the books that I'm reading. So I am involved and a presence. I don't operate the cash register, and when I do, it is a disaster. I'm much more likely to wrap a gift. It used to be when I went into the bookstore, I would check myself out. So if I bought a couple of books, I would go back behind the cash register and ring myself up. And it was a nightmare because every time I would step behind the cash register, every single person in the store who was shopping would immediately form a line in front of me.
Oh.
They wanted me to check them out.
It's like...
And I'm not good. You know, I'm just not good. So finally, a couple of people who work at the store suggested that I stop checking myself out because it was such a disaster if I had to ring 10 people up.
Well, and you are sort of, I imagine, a part of why the store has succeeded. But I imagine, too, that you're at this point more of something, you know, like people enjoy seeing Woody Allen walk into the place that he's known to go to play his clarinet.
Right.
But it's not why the place succeeds. And I would think it's the same thing. It sounds like it's a wonderful store and that she does a fabulous job.
Karen and I both have our jobs, and I believe very much that I am a big part of why the bookstore succeeds, in part because people come from all over the country to see this bookstore. I mean, the bookstore really exists, at least in the mind, the collective American mind, as this emblem of a small business that's come back, or the return of the bookstore. I do so much press and publicity for the bookstore.
Mm.
But the thing that I really bring to the game, I bring the authors,
mm-hmm.
because I know everybody.
Yeah.
And if I don't know the person, I know their agent, I know their editor. Or because I have become this sort of national figure in the publishing industry, in the book business, even if I don't know that person, I can exert the weight on it. For example, last night, it was unbelievable. And I flew home last night in order to get back to Nashville in time to do the introduction. We had Doris Kearns Goodwin.
And oh, wow.
We hosted her at a high school in town. We had about 750 people. John Meacham lives in Nashville now. Mm-hmm. So we had John Meacham and Doris Kearns Goodwin in conversation. So just unbelievable to have two Pulitzer Prize winning American historians who are friends sitting there talking about Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and The Bully Pulpit. It is such an extraordinary book. I am a huge fan of Doris's, but I don't know her. I met her once at a party, and I really didn't know anyone at Simon & Schuster, her publisher, and our events and marketing person called. And they said, no, we're not sending her to Nashville. We're not sending her to Nashville. We went back so many times. And I was pulling out all the stops. You know, I was calling everybody saying, get me an in with the head of Simon & Schuster. This is going to happen. I love Doris Kearns Goodwin. I have read all of her books. And I am going to move heaven and earth to get her to come to Nashville and to show them that we can do a great event, that we can get 750 people into an auditorium who will buy the books. So that's the kind of thing that I can do that I think a regular bookstore owner can't do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought about that before, but sure, that's wonderful that you can bring people in that will create that much more interest, too.
And in the 2 weeks before I left on book tour, we had Donna Tartt, Garrison Keillor, Wally Lamb, Liz Gilbert, and Pat Conroy, who I interviewed on stage.
Right, he's got the death of Santini now, right?
Yeah, which is terrific. I really, really enjoyed that book and enjoyed him so much. And he's somebody that, again, brought in an audience of 700 people because his fans are... It's like a cult thing. They would have slept out on the sidewalk for 3 days to get a ticket to that event. They love him so much.
Yeah. Okay, a couple of the essays in here are about speeches that you gave. for convocations, I assume probably you've done graduation speeches. I'm not going to ask you specifically about those essays, but I'm curious, how hard is it to come up with something original and inspiring to say for one of these occasions?
You know, it's funny that you should ask that, because just before I got on the phone with you, I was emailing a local high school that had just asked me to give the graduation address at their high school. And I was like, I'm 200 emails behind right now. Let me think about this and I'll get back to you. It is harder to come up with something original for graduation than it is convocation. Mm-hmm. I would much rather do convocation speeches, which are, here you are at the beginning, you know, college is ahead of you, this is going to be so much fun, take all of these different classes. That's really great. That is a great float to ride in the parade, the here we are at the beginning. Graduation is a lot tougher, especially in this economy. It's a little scary to say to kids, okay, now you're done. Really hope it works out for you. Good luck. But it's lovely. It's an honor. And it's its own interesting writing challenge. When I give speeches, I do them off the cuff. I don't get up and write a speech, unless it's a graduation speech, because they're usually so short, and there's a certain Rubik's Cube quality to the whole thing. You know, you just got to get all the colors lined up in this small space in a small period of time. You want to be able, in a speech like that, especially in a graduation speech in a short amount of time, what you want to do is give everyone a gift. You want to tell them something that they are going to have and to hold, hopefully for the rest of their life, that can be boiled down to one sentence that they'll take with them. And the reason this particular high school in Nashville asked me to give the graduation address, it's a public magnet school. And I have a couple of friends. My stepsister has twins there, and one of my best friends has twins there. So when the school asked me to come and give an assembly address, I said yes. And I went and I gave the assembly address, and it was a successful address, and the kids were great. But at the end of talking to them, I said, okay, now I want you all to pay attention. If you've been spacing out, pay attention to me right now, and I'm going to give you a gift, and I want you to hold this for the rest of your life and to always look back and say, this, on this day, I received this sentence, which is, the two things I would want to wish for you is that you be brave and that you be kind. And that in life, it kind of boils down to that more than anything, if you can be brave and be kind. And I said, and if you can't be brave, pretend to be brave, act brave. If you can't be kind, if kindness is not in your heart, act kind and pretend to be kind. And it was this huge thing. The kids all jumped up and cheered and applauded.
That's great.
And the kids in the school, you know, my nephews and my friends' children have said to me that kids come up to each other in the hall now and they say, be brave and be kind.
Oh.
And now they ask me to come back and give the graduation address, because it's like I have my own little cult at this high school. And I think, well, I guess I have to do it, right? Like, I can't not go.
Right. Oh, that's a wonderful message.
But it's a wonderful, it's a lot of work, but it's a great opportunity to boil down your thoughts and say, if I could tell this group of people one thing, you know, what would I want for them? How would I want to shape them? How would I want to put my little stamp on them? What could I say that might make their life easier and better?
Yeah.
That, you know, be brave, be kind. That would be it. That's what I would wish for you.
Yeah. You have an essay in here called The Wall, which was a wonderful. I loved reading that. It's about your experience of training to take the test to join the LAPD, even though you weren't planning to join the LAPD. Your father had spent his career there, and you wanted to write an essay about the process. And there were a couple things in this essay that made me think of this question. One was, you had noticed that a cop at whose desk you were sitting. He had a photograph tucked under the glass of his desk. It was a photograph of a young man who had died while trying to steal a car. Yeah. And you write, "What I want to ask, but what I don't ask, is why his picture is under the glass on the desk."
Right.
Later in the same essay, you're doing a ride-along, and you're sitting in the back of a patrol car, and these girls on the street sort of see you and make eye contact, and you assume that they are wondering what you've done to be
right.
picked up and sitting. And both of these are things that you comment on that don't really have an answer, but they ask interesting questions. And I liked that you included these in the essay, and I wondered if you might have anything to say about including this kind of observation in an essay.
Well, the thing about the officer who had the picture of the dead kid under the glass on his desk, which was so moving to me, mm-hmm. and it was just a Polaroid of this kid, and why had he picked this kid, and why did he want to look at this kid every day? What was he trying to keep in his own mind by having this picture under the glass of his desk? And I don't know what the answer is, but for me, if I were this cop, and that's the question, you are putting yourself in someone's shoes, and you don't know their answer, but it makes you ask a question about yourself. Why would I do it? What would it mean to me to have this kid's picture on my desk every day? I mean, in the same way you would have your own kid's picture on your desk at work. And that is the answer, that he is your own kid, that he is first and foremost maybe not a murderer or a thief, but a kid whose picture deserves to be on somebody's desk, who deserves to be remembered, who was also just someone's child, and that there seemed to be such humanity in that. Now, again, maybe that wasn't where it was that officer was coming from at all, mm-hmm. but it kind of reminded me of hanging on to one's humanity, that if you can hold on to the specific, then you're going to do a better job looking at something that's going to be the statistic of how many kids are killed and how many crimes are committed. And then as far as being a white woman in the back of a police car going through South Central LA and seeing these girls free out on the sidewalk looking at me, you know, mm-hmm. women of color, young women of color looking at me, a white woman in the back of the police car, and thinking, you know, what are they thinking? What are they thinking looking at me? They're looking at me so hard, and are they thinking, hey, sister, you too, man?
Yeah.
And that's, again, it's a moment of humanity. It's a moment of connection.
Yeah, I think that's what I really liked about it, is that these questions are important even if they aren't answered.
Boy, if we only asked the questions that we could answer, there would mm-hmm. be no point in it. Mm-hmm. And how you can write about something and years later go back and think, oh, I wonder if that's what it meant. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You don't get the answer at the time, or the answer will change over time. And it's wonderful also to have things that you then toss to the reader, because what you're saying is, I can't give you the answer. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that makes readers go a little deeper into it.
Hopefully.
Put themselves in there a little more. Okay, thanks. I wanted to... My last question has to do with revision. I don't know about you. I'm wondering, you know, is first draft harder or revision harder for you? And I also wondered if you could give a little advice for writers who might be listening about how to approach revising a novel. I know that's a huge question, but
no,
maybe you can take... Oh, okay, good.
No. And in the same way that how you write a novel or whether or not you know what the end is going to be, revision is a very personal thing. And how it works for one person is not going to be how it works for the other person. But this is the way I revise a novel. I write a chapter, and I then go back and work into that chapter over and over and over again. I will read it. I will polish it. I will, you know, if I'm on page 80, when I get to the desk at the morning, I'll go back to page 75 and I'll write into what I have already written. So mm-hmm. I am constantly folding. I mean, I think of it as like making a cake and folding in egg whites, folding in the air, folding in the lightness, having a batter that is dense and then folding in air and light and getting the voice just right. When I make a wrong turn, again, like driving, I know it's wrong and I can't go forward. I get stuck and I keep trying to go forward, but it won't let me because I've made a mistake 10 pages back, 15 pages back in that chapter. I can't go forward until I fix the mistake. Mm-hmm. When I finally get chapter 7 exactly where I think chapter 7 needs to be, I go on to chapter 8. When I finish writing a book, when I type the last page of the book, mm-hmm. that is 98% the book you are going to read. I don't write a draft of a novel and then say, now I'm going to start my second draft. Now I'm going to start my third draft. Now this character is going to have a sister. Now I'm going to set it in Tennessee instead of Arizona. That's not the way I work. I really approach revision as a chapter-by-chapter process that allows me to move forward.
Okay, and that sort of helps explain why you maybe work better if you sort of have the structural vision ahead of time, because you kind of need that if you're going to work that way, right?
Yes, but I know a lot of people who will finish a draft of a book and then go back and make all sorts of deep structural changes. I just couldn't do that. I couldn't stand to do that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stand to look back and say, wow, I need to dump that 100 pages and take this in an entirely different direction. That's just not the way I work. I'll change my mind about direction over and over and over again while I'm working on something in my head or when I'm just starting it. But it's very physical. I'm putting my foot down and I'm getting my balance and I'm getting centered, and then I'm moving my other foot forward and I'm putting my foot down. You know, that's it. I'm very steadily and thoughtfully walking ahead.
Okay, great. So I want to just repeat the name of the book. This is The Story of a Happy Marriage by Ann Patchett, published by Harper. Ann, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
It was so lovely to talk to you. I really enjoyed this conversation, and thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org, this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Ann Patchett. You can learn more about her work at annpatchett.com. Recent impeachment coverage has me remembering that when I was 9 years old, Richard Nixon's impeachment hearings were on TV every afternoon, preempting my cartoons. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a child's perspective on some contemporary political moment. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Next week on Write the Book, my guest will be Jessica McDiarmid, author of Highway of Tears, a true story of racism, indifference, and the pursuit of justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, published by Atria. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And that's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. Look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.